Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to be looking at another film by Vincenzo Natali, the producing director on Disco, Splice.
Yeah, Splice, a delightful little romp through scientific ethics. It was released in 2009, and it stars Adrian Brody and Sarah Polley as two scientists who apparently never read Frankenstein or learned the lessons from it that there are certain things one should not do in a science lab.
Yeah, you know, I mean, hey, everyone's gotta learn at their own pace, I guess, right?
I suppose. I would prefer that they learn before creating something that could, you know, wipe out humanity, but that's cool.
Yeah. So, okay, this is a movie which, as we were saying, is directed by Natali. Now, we talked about Cube during Shocktober.
Yes.
And this one, I think, could fall under the Shocktober heading as well.
Yeah, it could.
And it's about these two genetic engineers who are, you know, experimenting with gene splicing and whatnot. Yeah. And, you know, their work is maybe not progressing as much as they'd hope. And they decide, even though they are, like, definitely at the top of their field, And they decide that they should take things to the next level by adding some human DNA to the equation. And their experiment kind of gets out of hand, and basically a human animal hybrid is created, which is growing at a very, very fast rate and becoming extremely smart. And
yeah, I mean, I think that in a certain sense you could definitely say that this this on some basic conceptual level shares, you know, inspiration alongside Species with Natasha Henstridge.
Yeah, a movie which I still haven't seen.
You don't need to.
Okay.
You really don't need to.
Yeah, one day, yeah. one day I will see it. And yeah, Natali, as we said, he's going to be a director on Star Trek Discovery. And like the lead director from accounts, and one interesting note along those lines is that the production designer is a guy named Todd Chernyowski. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but
no, I think that's right.
Okay, he is going to be a production designer on Discovery as well. So
I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, the production design's good.
Yeah, it is. It is. I liked it. I mean, there's some stuff, even like subtle stuff. Like, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in like labs and stuff like that. But like the thing that kind of stood out to me, which, you know, granted is rather, you know, loud, you know, maybe slightly over the top, is when you see them in their bedroom and there's this massive graphic of from like a manga or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
And it's
it struck me more as anime.
Yeah.
Than manga.
Yeah.
So.
And it very much kind of like speaks to the internal you know, conflict inside the characters, I think, and as well as being true to their characters you know, personality-wise and everything. And I don't know, that definitely it stood out to me as being something which was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely successfully conveyed the idea that they were hip rock and roll scientists.
Yeah, working they at a place where the acronym is NERD.
Yeah, they weren't those stodgy Ivy League scientists that we've all grown so sick of. They loved heavy metal.
Yeah,
and they had patches on their lab coats.
Yeah,
and apparently didn't have ethics courses in their college.
You know, I mean, these things happen.
Yeah.
So what did you think about the movie?
I was a little underwhelmed. I didn't find the problem to be the direction so much as I thought that the right, I mean, you know, you have to fault the directing to a certain extent, but I think that there wasn't a clean progression for the character development or for the story arc. Like it seemed to jump back and forth between who had a problem with what, which I guess sort of speaks to the theme of, you know, at what stage do you think X action is wrong, you know, or justified or whatever. But it almost seemed like an anthology of events, almost like a TV series crushed into, you know, like a 2-hour thing instead of something that really like breathed organically. I mean, in terms of how it looked, I thought it looked great. Knowing who the director was, I could see stuff that would later come into play in Hannibal in terms of how he staged stuff and the way he would separate out a character through color and stuff like that. So, you know, like looks wise, I thought that I thought it was great, but for me, it was disjointed. What about you?
I liked it quite a bit. You know, I mean, like I definitely wanted to see it when it came out because of, you know, my fondness for Cube, but at the same time, you know, there's something about like this particular type of horror, you know, body horror or whatever you want to call it, you know, this kind of like Cronenbergish, you know, sort of thing where, you know, it freaks me out. You know, I'm not easily freaked out by movies, you know. I mean, I tend to fall asleep during exorcism movies, for example, but you know, this type of thing, there's something about it which is just it creeps me out. And, you know, you see the posters or whatever, and I'm just like, that looks absolutely terrifying, as it's supposed to, you know? So, yeah. Like, I was rather squeamish watching the movie, but at the same time, I found it to be incredibly compelling. And, you know, I think that a lot of the, you know, sort of like ethical questions which it brings up are definitely interesting, you know? And I think that it does a thing which I think you always want movies to do, but movies rarely ever do, which is kind of like always have you guessing as to what's going to happen next and sort of like, you know, always surprising you. I mean, this movie goes to some really, really weird places. And I found myself repeatedly just being like, what? Oh my God, we're doing this now? Okay. You know, and it's...
Yeah, but I mean, I think that speaks to, you know, the impression I got that it's almost like a series of vignettes, as opposed to an actual like one single story arc sort of thing. It's almost like a collection of short stories that are related to each other. It's not that disjointed. That's painting too rough a picture of it, but the fact that it would seem every so often to hit the reset button and say, okay, we asked that question long enough. Now let's ask this one. It was like,
I don't know. I think that there was a natural progression, you know, and that didn't bother me so much. You know, I think they do some really interesting things with the characters, you know, and their growth. And, you know, the idea that, you know, what we see on the surface is maybe not really what's going on in terms of motivations and things like that. And I think they do some really interesting stuff, like especially with, you know, Sarah Polley's character who you know, they introduce some strange elements to as the movie progresses. And
right. but that's sort of like the thing about, you know, look at your family history. Okay, are we going to follow that up better than this? What are we doing? Okay. All right. Well, we've moved on. Okay. That's fine.
See, that's how I felt originally. Like, you know, at one point in the movie, they decide to go to her old family farm, you know, where her mom, you know, raised her. And, you know, they go there and they start doing this whole thing where it's like, oh, you know, her mom was really, you know, sort of like abusive, at least emotionally. And it really made an impact on her, you know, and her life. And then her being here, you know, what does that mean? And as it was happening, I was like, how are they going to like tie this in to this story? Because it really does not seem relevant to the story at hand. And then it becomes, you know, very relevant, you know, towards the end. And I think that that ends up being, you know, really, really interesting. And, you know, while this is a horror movie with a monster, you know, it's also kind of weird because, you know, the places where you find evil may not be where you expect them, you know, and it almost becomes like psychological horror instead of, you know, body horror about, you know, halfway through. And I found that to be fascinating, you know.
But this is the thing, is it's not that I'm disagreeing with you that it goes to that place. It's that for me, looking at it in the whole, it didn't complete it basically had a series of arcs as opposed to a complete arc for any of them. Although arguably the Dren does have her own full arc. Like that I thought was the thread that worked best. What was, you know, the creature, for lack of a better term, you know, Dren following that creature from birth to adulthood, that seemed to have the most sort of cohesive, you know, story to it. Whereas, yes, I saw where the psychological stuff from her childhood played in, but it didn't mesh. It felt like something from another, you know, another story arc or another movie brought in and sort of grafted on for part of it, as opposed to naturally interweaving. Like I saw what they did with it. I understood what they were trying to say with it, but I just didn't think it worked. It didn't mesh the way that it needed to.
I mean, I guess I can kind of see that, but I don't particularly agree with it. I mean, okay. You know, where they're at the start of the movie is, you know, one place, and through circumstances in the movie, they end up in a different place, which is sort of going to have its natural effect on the characters at play. You know, as elements are introduced, you know, the characters are changing, and, you know, those events which feel like they wouldn't necessarily mesh with the stuff that happened earlier, I think it seems like it just makes sense for it to go to those other places. They're places you would not expect it to go when you start, but I think the way that the story is structured, the way that the characters develop, and I think that, you know, Sarah Polley's character and Adrian Brody's character, along with Dren, have, you know, some pretty great arcs. I mean, where they start at the beginning and where they end up is completely different, but you definitely see that progression. And they're almost like opposite sides of you know, a coin. And, you know, one of them is at one end and one of them is at another end at the start of the movie. And then they almost crisscross as the movie ends, you know?
They do, in a way. But, I guess the only way that I can really say it is that I think that there were certain parts of it that needed to breathe more, that needed to develop a little bit longer before they, you know, shifted to the next, you know, next part of the movie. I think that this movie would have benefited from like another 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, just to let it breathe and develop further. I mean, I don't want it to come across as though I disliked it. Mm-hmm. I wasn't nuts about it, but, you know, I wasn't upset at the end, like, because there were definitely elements that I really liked about it. Primarily the stuff that I really liked all had to do with the cinematography and the design. Greg Nicotero of Walking Dead fame did, I think they said 13 designs of the Dren character.
Oh, really? Yeah.
They had like 13 different distinct stages that they progress her through. So like some of the changes are very, very subtle. But they actually went to the trouble of like evolving the character. Like, what's it going to look like from here to here? And I think that pays off big time, because the Dren character, you know, even when they're using the CG that doesn't always work as well as they obviously wanted it to, looks great.
Yeah.
And is an intriguing and believable creature that you're looking at. You know, even when it's CG. And the actress, there's not a chance I'm going to pronounce her name right, that played Dren.
Yeah.
When she got older, did a great job of her physicality, the real parts of her meshing with the stuff that was CG enhanced. Like, it looked like a cohesive picture of everything. So she did a fantastic job.
Yeah, she was really good. You know, I mean, she obviously had a very hard job, because in addition to being, you know, partially CGI, she's also playing something that's not quite human and yet something that you had to relate to, something which
right.
is horrifying and at the same time basically like a cute little kid, you know, in a sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really weird. I mean, there's like one moment where she gets loose in a forest, you know, and they go looking yeah. for her, and they find her, you know, sitting down in the middle of the woods, like devouring a rabbit. And you see, you know, meat and blood and everything just dripping out of her mouth. And you're like, that's the most horrifying thing ever. And then she just gives this smile, like a little kid giving a smile, like, hey, you know, yeah. What's going on? You know, yeah. and it's very interesting that dichotomy that they play with throughout the movie, you know, and she definitely pulled yeah. that off well. And I mean, Adrian Brody and Sarah Polley, you know, I mean, they're so good in everything, but I think, you know.
You know, that was actually something that I was really struck by was, yes, Sarah Polley is great and Adrian Brody is great. And it's, they do give performances that are good enough that every so often you see a movie. And even though, again, that, you know, I wasn't nuts about the movie, I watched the two main actors and thought to myself, why aren't they even more famous than they are? You know, like, yeah. you know Adrian Brody and you know Sarah Polley, but they're not like Leonardo DiCaprio level. And I'm like, I'd like to see these people be that level of stardom, because mm-hmm. they've got some major talent. Like, Sarah Polley completely sold me. I completely believed her.
Yeah. I mean, Adrian Brody, you know, he's got an Oscar yeah. and everything. So, you know, that's, you know.
I mean, that's a measure of some success, but you know what so. I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he doesn't command the $20 million movie, and I think he should.
No, that's true.
Of course,
true.
He made his mistake of being in King Kong, but hey.
I mean, was that a mistake? I don't know.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I mean, it was.
I mean, like, I'm not going to defend King Kong. I saw it one time in the theater opening night and was like, that was fine. You know,
we saw it at the second run theater, local to us. And I spent about 10 minutes in the middle trying to talk my wife into leaving the movie.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
she liked it more than I did. And she's like, no, I'm going to stay. And I was like, fine. I'm just going to go get some popcorn. I'll be back in a minute.
Well, maybe you should try the extended cut.
Oh, that sounds awful. No.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, but he's a good actor for sure. I mean, he's been yeah. in a lot of stuff, which I have liked. I mean, Predators comes to mind for some reason. I don't know.
Predators is a fantastic,
yeah.
underrated, overlooked little gem.
Yeah, easily the best Predator movie ever made.
Oh, I see. The thing is, I have nostalgia on the first one. I mean, I can't walk away from the first one, because any movie where two of the main characters greet each other by giving each other like that half high five, that's like an arm wrestling move.
And then it's just like 30 seconds of them. Muscles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, come on. That's such cheesy goodness. You got to love it.
That is probably the most homoerotic scene in movie history, you know? And
More than Top Gun's volleyball scene?
Well, I guess that you're okay.
That's your gold yeah. standard right there.
Yeah. And yeah. and while I did appreciate that, you know, I mean, I don't know, Predator, it just, I don't know, that movie just does not work for me. It's too straightforward, I think. I don't know. Predators, I thought, was an interesting twist on the material, but regardless of that.
I definitely agree. Well, I would have loved to see, they're working on another one. I wanted to see Adrian Brody come back, but I don't think he's going to.
No. I mean, originally the plan, because they had like this massive plan for Predators, you know, it was going to be that yeah. was essentially the first half of like a much larger movie, and then they decided to do this and then hopefully get a bigger budget to have it like the second movie. But yeah, unfortunately that didn't happen. But no, but I mean, the new Predator movie is going to be great. I mean, it's being directed by Shane Black, who starred in the first Predator movie. He
there
was
you
one
go.
Of the guys. And it's being co-written by Black and Enterprise's Fred Decker. So
no kidding. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so we can cover it on this show when it comes out.
That's kind of exciting.
So, but yeah, I mean, Adrian Brody, he's good. I mean, I guess most people would probably reference, you know, stuff like The Pianist and his Wes Anderson stuff before Predators, but, you know, whatever. I mean, sure, he's good in those things too. But like Sarah Polley, I mean, I really love Sarah Polley. I've always loved Sarah Polley going back to The Sweet Hereafter. Did you ever see that?
Never saw The Sweet Hereafter, no.
Oh, if you want something which is a laugh riot, fun for the whole family.
I feel like I'm being set up here.
It's the feel-good movie of the year. Check out...
I'm not falling for this.
The Sweet Hereafter. But no, it is really good, even though it's, you know, one of the most depressing movies in, you know, the history of man. And she's really good in it, even though she's only like... she was really young when that movie came out, you know, a teenager, I think. And then, you know, Go... And, you know, all the stuff, you know, leading up, and not to mention the fact that she's, you know, a very acclaimed director, writer and director herself. I think she was nominated for best screenplay at one point. So that's really cool. And maybe that's why, you know, she's not as big of a star as, you know, some of these other people, because, I mean, I guess what she's primarily an actor, but it seems like her passions, you know, lie more behind the camera, you know what I mean?
Right. She's more full picture creative than pouring all of her efforts into one channel.
Yeah. But it's cool that a movie like this can attract such, you know, high caliber talent, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things which I think is interesting about, you know, the movie. You know, a lot of horror movies, you know, obviously gear towards younger demographics, you know, and tend to be, you know, populated by, you know, teenagers or college aged, you know, performers, just because, you know, they want to make it more relatable to the youngins. But, you know, here, I mean, even though they are, you know, young, hip, cool scientists, right? They're still, you know, adults, and that's kind of cool. I do appreciate that.
Yeah, they're doing adult type stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. And I mean, the other thing which I think is really cool, you know, I just love this in general, is this production company which made this movie, Dark Castle.
Yeah.
They're the guys. I mean, it was basically started by like the Tales from the Crypt guys, you know?
I didn't know that.
Zemeckis and Joel Silver and everything like that. And
okay.
I think the original idea was that they were going to be remaking a bunch of, you know, William Castle movies. And that's where the name comes from, Dark Castle.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, they kind of do these like low budget horror type of movies. You know, they've branched out a few different places and everything like that. And I think Zemeckis has, you know, taken a step back from being, you know, as active as he was, you know, and that kind of thing. But, you know, it's just such a great idea for a you know, little production shingle, as they call it, or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And there was one tidbit I read, you know, after watching it, that I think speaks to why Natalie might be so much more focused on television than on feature filmmaking ever since Splice. And that is, apparently the shoot was so grueling, according to the source that I was reading, that his hair turned gray while they were shooting it. Like, by the end of the shoot, his hair had turned gray. And I've never read any quote, but I would imagine that probably that means it was, you know, arduous enough that he said, I'm going to television, you know, like, you know, just to follow, you know, to... Because I keep referencing Kevin Smith working on Flash, you know, which you're the one that told me originally, where he's like, I could die tomorrow and like the show can go on. I imagine it's probably stressful, but at the same time, there's a comfort. There seems to be more of a, you know, because judging by his work on Hannibal, he really seems to have embraced all of the visual stuff that he really loves doing, so that he doesn't have to worry about the day-to-day managerial stuff that like a film director has to worry about. It really seems like he's found a great channel for that.
Well, I imagine it is a different skill set in a lot of ways. I mean, this is a movie which he co-wrote himself, you know, and he directed, and because of that, it was probably, you know, very personal to him, and he had like a very specific vision for it, you know, and he needed to create that from scratch, essentially, you know. And all the stuff that goes on with that, I mean, while I think, you know, probably very satisfying on an artistic level, could also be extremely stressful, like you're saying, on a working level. And, you know, with television work, there's so many constraints in place already that you can kind of like narrow your focus to, you know, right, just a couple of specific things.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, and you can't help but wonder, because, like, I mean, Star Wars broke George Lucas in terms of directing. Like, he walked away for decades afterward. He was like, I can't do, like, you know, all of the stories are there where, like, he was nearly dead at the end of it. He was like, I can't do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And he steps back and he becomes a writer producer and appears to be much happier while he's doing it. You can't help but wonder, like, if Lucas had had this sort of avenue of, you know, today's television environment, would he have gone down that road instead of, you know, doing what he did? I don't think so, because I think his dream was to found a movie studio. But
I mean, I could definitely see it. I mean, the way that television is today and everything like that, I mean, I think that instead of, you know, doing what Natalie is doing and, you know, essentially directing for other people, I think he would have been the guy hiring Natalie, you know, to right, direct for him. But I could definitely see that, you know, as far as Lucas is concerned. I mean, you know, Natalie, as a TV director, he seems to be very sought after. And you look at, like, the work that he's doing and the shows that he's working on, it's not like, you know, Baywatch Nights or anything like that.
Yeah.
Not to say anything bad about Baywatch Nights, but, I mean, they introduced aliens into the Baywatch universe, so, I mean, there's that. But
it's canon.
Yeah, but, but, you know, the idea that he's working on shows like Hannibal and, you know, Luke Cage and Westworld and everything like that, you know, shows which are very visually striking and shows which are, you know, very prestigious in a lot of ways. And, you know, that's pretty cool. The Strain, you know, being another one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's exciting because I think his role on Disco will be, you know, different from those, because he it seems like he's going to have more creative control over, you know, the direction of the show,
right,
since, you know, people are going to be kind of following his lead instead of the other way around, you know?
right
So that's really exciting, for sure. But looking at this, I mean, looking at the visuals, you know, the photography, the shot composition, and not to mention the world creation and the ethical questions, you know, the sci-fi, mm-hmm, you know, ethical questions which are asked and everything. And also, I mean, the performances that he gets out of, you know, the three leads. I mean, it's all extremely impressive. You know, I mean, I like Cube a lot, but I think one of the things that makes me like it so much is the fact that it was so inventive given the, you know, budgetary restraints, you know, and
right,
that he was able to come up with all of this stuff with very, very limited means. You know, here, you know, obviously a much higher budget, you know, I didn't feel that so much, but I also felt like he had the ability to stretch his legs a bit, you know, and, mm-hmm, and explore some more ideas than he was able to in Cube. And I think I actually like this movie more than Cube. I mean, I don't know. It really kind of, I was expecting to like it, but I was not expecting to like it as much as I did. It really surprised me in a lot of ways, you know, in the best possible ways. And yeah, I don't know. It was really intriguing to me, I have to say.
I can say that visually I enjoyed it more than Cube, because he definitely shows more of a command of, you know, of the screen, of what's going on in the field and stuff like that. You can definitely tell that it's a director who's matured and figured out more about his own style.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, visually, I definitely think it's even more successful than Cube was. But Cube, you sort of like, you know, give it a break because, you know, it's obviously very low budget. And so they were very, very creative with what they had to do. But yeah. I mean, I wish it had clicked better for me, but, I definitely still think it's worth a watch. I mean, you obviously like it more than I did, and I can understand why, but for me, it just didn't gel at the end.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's fair for sure. For sure. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I definitely would, you know, recommend it as well. It's available on iTunes and whatnot. You know, you can rent it there, and I'm sure other places as well. And I mean, definitely, I would say worth checking out if you want to get an idea of Natali's visual style, and also, you know, some of the stuff that he can do inside the realm of science fiction. You know, I mean, definitely check out Cube as well. I think we both liked that one quite a bit. Yeah. So, for sure. Check it out and let us know what you think. All right. Well, it's been fun talking about Splice today, but that's not all we're talking about this week on Trek FM. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
And then as kind of a teenager, I kind of drifted a bit from Star Trek. And, you know, I pretended one time when I went to see Star Trek Nemesis that I was actually off to see Elf instead, because that sounded cooler than seeing Star Trek Nemesis. And maybe it still is.
To the journey!
Maybe even playing it with Tuvok, who I think will be brilliant at it. And then it just constantly going, brr, brr, like him just getting really annoyed.
Yeah. Tuvok would be the Operation Champ.
Yeah, he would. Yeah.
See, and then the evil holographic doctor from Equinox is singing, you know, the reticular nodes connected to the...
Yes.
Warp 5.
We should get Larry Nemechek on, and we should do a supplemental episode where we just talk and we act like we're Tellarites and we just insult each other for the whole episode.
He would probably love it.
What do you think? I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I don't know. That would be... I might have to get coached by our listeners.
Meta Treks.
And that's the world of language that we live in. It's not this purely referential sense of language. Like when Riker says a minuet, he doesn't just mean, oh, yeah, that thing minuet that I can point to, whatever that is on the holodeck, right?
The 17th century French dance. Maybe he wants to dance.
Riker wants to bust a move.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, our own website. You can just download the things there, or you can go to iTunes, of course. If you do go to iTunes, please subscribe to the show, because that really helps us out and makes it easier for other people to find the show when they're searching iTunes. And if you do go to iTunes, also leave us a review. And hey, we've got a contest going on right now for a prize pack of goodies donated to us by associate producer Jeff Sutter. These things include in this first prize pack, we have a set of blueprints from the 70s. For Star Trek, and a technical manual from the 70s for Star Trek.
And, awesome.
And yeah, they look really, really cool. So be sure to, you know, go on to iTunes, leave us a review. You have until January 16th to leave us a review, and you know, we'll read it on the air and everything. And then on episode 32, which comes out January 20th, we will announce the winner of the contest. So, you know, thank you very much, Jeff, for your donation, and thank you to everyone who leaves us a review. We also want to thank our other associate producers, Chris Steftenagel and Norman C. Lau. And if you want to be like Chris and Norm and Jeff, head on over to patreon.com and donate to Trek FM. That's
yes.
patreon.com/trekfm, patreon.com/trekfm, and we really appreciate your support. If you want to contact us, you can find us on Twitter at trekfm. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook. And you can tell us what you think about Splice. So, John, where can people find you on the internet?
Look for Kessel Junkie. And when you're not looking for Kessel Junkie, listen to him over on Great Shot Kid on the Nerd Party Network, where we analyze, me and Mike, the work of Star Wars creators. You can also hear me on Aggressive Negotiations with Matt Rushing and on Words with Nerds with Craig Sorrell.
And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, or you can find me over on thenerdparty.com doing Great Shot Kid along with John. And you can also find me finishing up from there to here.
Yes.
Tomorrow. It will be
so
our last episode. Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited.
Please tell me the show image is going to be you weeping softly.
Yeah, pretty much. You can also find me over on commentarytrackstars.com, where we just recently released our commentary for Mad Max Fury Road, and hopefully we'll have a few other things up there in the near future. All right, so that's it for this week. But next week, we will be back to talk about my favorite film, and yours too, John, I'm sure, which was written by the new executive producer on Star Trek Discovery, Akiva Goldsman, Batman Forever.